Hi, everybody.
Hello, friends.
And welcome to the 100th episode of
The Bitchery of History.
My name is Max.
I'm Allison.
And today I will be talking about Kate Ma Barker.
Ooh. I know nothing about her. Today, finally, on our 100th episode for our 100th lady, I'm going to be talking about Abigail Adams.
Yes.
Get it.
You've been talking about doing her
since like episode one.
Yeah.
I've been like, and then I'll do Abigail Adams. But first, like, we need to explore all the women of other cultures and other countries and their time periods of history and blah, blah, blah. And then cut to four seasons later, still haven't done Abigail Adams. So now
here we go.
Here we go.
It's interesting because this is our 100th episode, mm-hmm. but it is our 200th and 201st ladies because we had that.
Oh, that's true. I definitely called Abigail the 100th lady. She's 200.
200, yeah. She's because we had that episode, that Christmas episode.
Oh, yeah.
On the Virgin Mary.
But we also had that episode where Jeanette did a lady.
We've had two episodes where we did three ladies.
What was the other one?
It was this season. It was earlier this season. Remember, you did a lady and then I did a lady.
Oh, that's true. And then
lady.
I did a lady because right. I had two short stories.
Correct.
That's true.
Yeah.
So everything evened out in the end.
Everything evens out.
Equality.
Equality.
Max and I are both a little loopy. Apologies.
Yeah. You may have noticed that we haven't had an episode since Women's History Month.
Yes.
Since those speeches.
Yes.
How much fun were those?
So fun. And Max did so much work editing all those speeches, getting all the people together to record those speeches. I just want you all to know that Max is a great host.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I do my best. I want to thank once again, I know we've thanked them in multiple places, multiple times, but again, thank you to the ladies of It's Personal.
Yes, absolutely.
What a group of ladies.
Oh, those speeches, man.
Amazing. And those speeches, you know, they were so much fun to do. And we've had pretty good reception from them in terms of downloads that I think we should make it a yearly thing.
I'm down.
Yeah.
Because listening to the speeches and even just like researching the speeches that we thought we might want to do.
Yeah.
It's like on the one hand, it's there's such a rallying cry and a like, yes, women, go, all the things. But then, like, the Declaration of Sentiments, it's also, like, a really good and stark reminder of how far we still have to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because some of those sentiments have not been dealt with.
Yeah.
And it is, like, over 100 years later.
Yeah, absolutely. So. And I think it's interesting how Sarah Grimke wrote those letters, and they provided the framework of language for so many people.
Yeah.
I mean, that language, doing those speeches, gives us language still today. Like, you don't have to reformulate an argument. Just listen to how Sarah Grimke said it, or how Sojourner Truth said it, or how Nellie McClung satirized it at that mock parliament.
Ugh.
And the last thing I'll say before we dive into our 200th lady is how nice it was to have the whole team together again. Well, Jeanette, you know, over the phone, but
over the Skypes,
to have everyone in the same room together.
That was really nice.
That was really nice.
Let's get to touch base with everybody.
Yeah.
I was going to say about 200 ladies.
Uh-huh.
So when I was looking up, cause I knew I wanted to do Abigail Adams, which we hadn't really put sort of into our planned calendar.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I should, for my second lady, do somebody that also wasn't on the calendar. So I'm not like messing anything up.
Uh-huh.
I was like, oh, I want to go back to Rejected Princesses. I haven't been on that website in a while. I just want to see like who I might find or who might be interesting. And what was crazy is, first of all, going on Rejected Princesses and being like, oh, all these badass women. Yes. There's so many more stories
season
out
five,
there.
Season six.
Yeah.
Season
there's so,
seven.
Like, so that was all happening. And a lot of the stories that I found were amazing. Some of them were too short. So then I went back into like our big Google Drive folder where we have a sheet of just like ladies who we want to research, mm-hmm. people that have been recommended to us, people that we know we want to cover later.
People we've come across in the
research about other ladies. Yeah, and we're just like, I want to do that later. Mm-hmm. And scrolling through that lengthy list of people we still haven't covered and then looking up some of those women to see who I wanted to cover for this episode, it brought home to me again that even four seasons in, 200 women and like 200 women against the entire annals of human history is like 0.00001%.
Right. Not even the size of my high school graduation class.
Yeah, it's like nothing.
Right.
So there's so many more to go, and I'm very excited.
And the fact that 200 women and how many of them had you heard of before? How many of those names, how many of the women we covered were like discoveries when you were researching someone else and you found their name just kind of popped up?
Yeah.
And then you went on to find just reams of information about them.
Yeah.
And you go, how?
How have I never heard of this person?
How is there this much information about somebody or something that I've never heard of even tangentially?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be optimistic and say mm-hmm. I knew about 50 women.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair.
But honestly, if I sat down and looked at our episode list, it's probably less, which is a great thing.
Absolutely. Can I ask you one last question before before we dive in? 200 ladies in, mm-hmm. well, 199 ladies in.
Uh-huh.
Who sticks out to you as your favorite so far?
Max, I think about this all the time. it's Marie Marvin.
Oh,
from France.
Yes.
Nothing tops her. Like, of all of the stories that we have talked about and gone, oh, why isn't there a movie about this? Why isn't there a TV show about this? Her story, I still remember, I don't even remember how I found her, but I do remember that the first place I was reading about her was on Wikipedia.
Hmm.
And reading all of her accomplishments and everything that she did, I honestly had the thought, is this article fake? Because it's Wikipedia, and I am so blown away by what I'm reading that I don't know if it's real. And so I had to go back to Google and find a bunch of other sources to like confirm everything that I had read. And it was all true and all accurate.
Yeah.
Down to the, here's a gold medal for sports.
For sports.
Well, just all of them.
Yeah.
We're done tracking what you're good at and what you're going to win at. So just have a gold medal for sports and we will see you later. What about you?
You know, to be honest, I think it's Lynn Hill.
Really?
Yeah. I think especially after the documentary came out, Free Solo with Alex Honnold, who climbed the nose. Yeah. The fact that she was the first person to do it, I think there's something.
I have to say, I did go and watch it, and I was a little bit sad that they didn't mention her ever.
I agree.
Just a little bit. Like I agree. I totally get it. You have to stay very focused on, you know, the documentary subject and like not get too tangential with things.
And it is a fantastic documentary.
It really is.
It's great.
But I was, because I couldn't remember her name when we mm-hmm. went to go see it.
Right.
And they spend so much time like talking about climbing and climbing El Capitan. And I was like, oh, aren't they going to name the woman?
Right.
So I can remember what her name was.
Right.
And they never did. And I was like, well, damn it.
I think there's something in me that just kind of, when I think about it, because we've done other amazing women, right? The Pirate Lord Ching Shi.
I was going to bring her up,
who
too.
Who is honestly
crazy.
Possibly one of the most badass
ever in history. And I have to tell you something really cute. This is such a long side tangent. But the other day, Preston came out of the kitchen. He was like, Allison, I have heard about the most amazing woman ever. She was this pirate. She was crazy. And he starts telling me the whole thing. And I was just like, You mean Ching Shi from episode one of my podcast?
Episode one, Preston. Where you at, boy?
Yeah. What have you been doing in the past, 2 years we've been together? You not been listening to my podcast?
Right.
Apparently not.
Wow.
Rude.
Call him out.
I totally did. And now I've called him out on the podcast. So when he listens to it, he's going to be like, what the heck?
What the heck, Allison? I know. But there's something about it that even as like amazing as that story is and how badass that story is, it doesn't feel relatable. There's still, exactly. There's barrier there. And there's something about the physical act of climbing and how deep I got into for that story. Cause I went on a like weeks long after we recorded that just binge. And I think I've probably watched every single free climbing YouTube video now that's on YouTube. And there's something that's just so visceral.
Yeah.
And terrifying.
Yeah.
About it. Monumentally terrifying.
Yeah.
About it. That just amazes me.
Yeah.
And the fact that now she leads self-help classes out in like New Mexico or something.
But can
like
you?
That.
I mean, no, that
she's
is
she's exactly who I would want to be. To lead. Yeah,
that's. I mean, that's what I was gonna say because I was talking to somebody recently about sort of. You know, I get asked fairly frequently. I guess I don't know, but I have been asked multiple times like, you're just so motivated, like you work so hard at everything you do and you like run every day and I wish I could get up at 5 a.m. and go running and like, how do you do it? And I'm always just like, I honestly, like, I don't know. Like I just set an alarm and then I do it because like I said I would do it. So I have to do it.
Right.
And I don't have any way to translate that into like a teachable skill to other people.
Right.
But I was like, man, if I did, I'd be a millionaire. Like I would make so much money if I could transform my like inner motivation into an outer class. But anyway, so I was talking about this, about that to someone. And then I was just like, but you know, running has given me so much confidence. Mm-hmm. We'll get into this with my other lady, but there is just something in that like physical act and doing something that you thought was impossible.
Absolutely.
And pushing yourself and working really hard and getting to that point where you actually go out and do it, that you're just in like, whatever, life, come at me. I can totally handle it. I am fine.
Right.
And it's the best. It's absolutely the best feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you think when we were sitting on my couch, which is, you know, literally 15
right
feet
there
from where we're sitting right now, that we would get here?
No.
I didn't either. I didn't either.
Which maybe sounds terrible, but like that's just being honest. Yeah. I mean, we have really been through it, man, with this podcast.
Wow.
There have been some ups and some downs.
For real, though.
Yeah.
For real. I mean, this has, the audience hasn't seen this part of it, but there have definitely been trying friendship times.
Yeah, I was going to say treacherous moments. I mean, there's trying friendship times. I think our friendship always was...
Yeah. Well,
you know,
because we're good at communication and...
Yeah, was going to be there, but there were definitely times where I was just like, do we just stop?
Yeah.
Do we just not?
Yeah.
But here we are.
Here we are.
Thanks to our listeners.
Yes.
Yeah. Totally.
Honestly, thank you so much.
For real, though.
Thank you so much. Thank you so
much. It really means a lot to me that there are people that are listening to this and hopefully learning about women
and we
and
get
women's history.
And we've been getting messages from people on Instagram and on Facebook from people who like, I listen to this with my daughters or I listen to this.
Shut up. Why have you never sent me that? Because I would cry. That's why. Because, you know, I would just be weeping in the corner.
Yeah.
You did send one though recently that somebody had commented or
Ima
had tagged
Sumer. Yeah.
Had tagged us in the comments, and I was like, because I was like, that was one of my ladies.
Uh-huh.
I found her.
Yeah.
I did the research.
It was the official Ima Sumac.
Yeah, which is amazing because also I remember that episode of finding the clip of her singing. And also just being like, WTF,
absolutely,
this is one person's voice. Like, get out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so just having people discover things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And also hearing stories of people that are like them from their background or their culture or doing things that they want to do but might not have the courage to do yet. Like, who knows who went and took up rock climbing because of the Linda Hill episode? We don't know.
God,
if it was
so.
You, please text us or email us immediately because we want to know. Text us. They don't have our number.
Text us. If you text me, I will be very surprised.
But message us. Message us on one of our social media platforms.
Yeah. Instagram,
tag us
Facebook,
in a picture of you rock
Twitter.
Climbing.
Yeah.
Oh. Done. I'm dead.
Allison's weeping.
I am.
She's weeping.
So much.
So thank you to our listeners. And Allison, thank you.
Thank you, Max.
Yeah. When we met, no, going even further back. When we met.
This episode is not even going to have Lady Sim in. It's just going to be us reminiscing, which I'm totally fine with.
It's fine.
Totally fine.
It's our 100th episode.
This is true. Okay, so going even further back to what? The first day we ever met?
When we met on that first day of college, could you picture this?
Absolutely not. Because so many people also at UNCG didn't want to move to LA.
That's true.
And
most of our,
so,
I think most of our classmates ended up in New York.
When did I find out that you wanted to move to LA? Did we talk about that in school?
No, I don't. I didn't know that I wanted to move out here till my junior year.
Yeah, so I was already gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a time.
What a time.
Well, shall we?
Shall we?
Abigail Adams,
let's
are you ready?
Shall. I.
Let's
am
shall.
So ready.
How much
yes,
do you?
Let's shall.
That's what you said.
I know it is.
Okay.
And I meant it.
Great. Okay.
How much do I know about Abigail Adams?
Yeah.
I know.
Very little.
I know that she like implored her husband to help write women into the sequel. Or is that?
Wow. That's Hamilton.
No, I know. But didn't Abigail Adams have a quota?
She was.
Said about
Abigail
that?
Adams was not waiting for a sequel. Okay. She wanted first edition. Okay. Born in, she was born in 1744.
Okay.
In Massachusetts, about 12 miles from Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Abigail Smith.
Okay.
Her father, William Smith, was minister of the First Congregational Church, and also he made a living as a farmer. And he and his wife, Elizabeth Quincy Smith, you might know the name John Quincy Adams.
Uh-huh.
Just spoiler alert. They both belonged to very distinguished families in New England. And Elizabeth's father, John Quincy, so Abigail's grandfather, her maternal mm-hmm. grandfather, was active in the colonial government and served as Speaker of the Massachusetts Assembly for 40 years.
Whoa.
And his career in public service, probably we can take to be a huge influence on his granddaughter. Yeah, 40 years.
40
That's
years.
A long time.
Is a long time in leadership.
Yeah. Abigail was educated at home with her siblings, and she read a lot from the family library. When she was 11, she and her sisters began receiving private, you know, in-home tutoring from Richard Cranch, a transplant from England, who later married Abigail's older sister, Mary.
Okay.
Now, this is only important because Richard had a friend, a young upstart lawyer named... No!
Oh.
It's not Hamilton.
Okay.
A young upstart lawyer named John Adams.
Oh, that makes more sense.
There you go.
Yeah.
John met Abigail when she was 17 years old, and after a long engagement, they married in October of 1764 when Abigail was 19.
Wow.
And John was 28, which I actually think is pretty normal.
Yeah.
For the 1700s.
At least she wasn't 14.
Yeah. Well, it says her parents insisted on the long engagement. So, I mean, they were like, you have to be over 18, even though that was not a thing.
Right.
Now, here is a fun piece of information. Just 9 months after their marriage, Abigail gave birth to the couple's first child. So part of me does wonder if it was like, yo, mom, we gotta get married, like, right now.
I know we've been. I know you wanted a 3-year engagement,
but it's going to only
be
two.
Two.
Which, I mean, who knows? It is 9 months, so it's perfectly plausible. But it does. It certainly does make me question a little bit. Just
It could be that they consummated the marriage with a baby,
right?
Yeah.
Which, yeah, exactly. So I'm like, it's totally plausible, but it does make me think, like, oh, is that why the long engagement came to an end?
Sure.
They just couldn't wait any longer. Ooh. Abigail's first child was also named Abigail, but they called her Nabby. which is kind of a terrible nickname, what? In my opinion. Nabby.
Nabby?
N-A-B-B-Y. Nabby.
What's wrong with Abby?
I guess it's too similar to Abigail? I don't know.
Nabby.
She would have 6 children in all, 4 of whom lived into adulthood, including Nabby.
Sure. Of course she did.
Right? John Quincy, Charles, and Thomas. Now, in 1774, so 10 years after they've been married, John Adams headed to Philadelphia for the first Continental Congress. Aww. And this is when he and Abigail began writing to each other very regularly. Mm-hmm. And their correspondence is just like a massive treasure trove of historical information and significance. And especially because, you know, it's their personal letters. So they're not... It's not like this is the official thing from Congress that we're writing down.
It's less guarded, contemporaneous.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Now, Abigail herself supported independence, obviously.
Duh.
And she famously argued that it should be applied to women as well as men. So during the Second Continental Congress, as John Adams and all the other delegates were really getting down into the nitty-gritty of formally declaring independence and putting it down into the declaration and signing it and sending it over to good old King George, Abigail wrote to her husband from her home in Braintree, Massachusetts. Now, at that time, women couldn't hold property, but she called it hers anyway, which I kind of like to think is because he was gone so long that she was just like, well, it's my home. You're not here, so it's mine.
Dibs.
Yeah. So she wrote, quote, and by the way, in the new code of laws, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. If particular attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. End quote. Ladies, who's taken to the streets with me. Who's taken to the streets.
Sounds a little like the Declaration of Sentiments.
Just a little. John Adams kind of replied in a joking manner.
Right.
And he expressed some fear over the despotism of the petticoat. And Abigail pushed back.
This ain't a joke, John. Making it clear
that she was serious. Yeah, duh. But we all know that it didn't really happen anyway, so sorry. Now, cut to Revolutionary War is done. Mm-hmm. John Adams served as the U.S. minister to France and then England.
Sure.
And so Abigail joined him in Europe in 1784, and they remained abroad in Europe for 5 more years. And they returned home in 1789 so that John could assume the vice presidency under George Washington. Mm-hmm. Over the next decade, Abigail spent her time between the U.S. Capitol, which was first New York, and then it was Philadelphia because D.C. was still being built. And Braintree, her home, where she managed the family farm, which is probably why she called it hers, because she was in charge.
Right.
And then this is what you will remember from Hamilton. So in 1793, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson stepped down, and it's hard to write this all in a rap song, but there was just serious fissures between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, who also were sometimes known as Jeffersonians, in Washington's cabinet. So when Washington announced his intention to retire, John Adams emerged as the leading candidate on the Federalist side with Jefferson as his main opponent.
Right.
So
this is states' rights versus one strong national government.
Mm-hmm. And up until this point, Abigail and John had actually been close friends with Thomas Jefferson, but the friendship was kind of over at that point because they became opponents for the presidency.
Right.
But John Adams won. I know him. That's a line from Hamilton.
Oh, right, yeah.
Great.
For the guy who's been quoting it this whole time.
Yeah, just for you. So John Adams becomes president. As first lady, Abigail maintained and voiced strong opinions about the political issues. She wrote, quote, I have been so used to freedom of sentiment that I know not how to place so many guards about me as will be indispensable to look at every word before I utter it and to impose a silence upon myself when I long to talk. End quote.
I love that. Wait, you want me to watch what I'm saying?
Oh, I'm sorry. I said this to somebody recently. I said, I'm sorry. Is my passion showing? Wait a minute.
So.
Which is really fascinating to read about because I was just reading Rebecca Traister's new book, Holler.
We should get her on this podcast.
Honestly, I will.
Start writing letters.
Yes, I'm on board.
That was to our listeners, but also to you, Allison.
Yes, we will make it happen. So I was just reading her new book, which was talking about how Michelle Obama had to undergo this sort of change when Obama was first running for the presidency from voicing her opinion so much about political issues to more the, well, I think these curtains will look good in the White House. I mean, that's not a real example, sure. But you get the idea.
Nonpartisan things like losing weight.
Eating healthy, which is important. But it kind of sounds like Abigail. So basically, Michelle Obama had to kind of like chill out.
Right.
And it sounds like Abigail didn't relax much.
No.
And was like, bye.
It sounds like someone said, Abigail, you should.
And she said, oh, I shouldn't what?
And she said, what?
I shouldn't tell you my opinions about everything.
Maybe you should shut up.
I love it. There was the 1800 presidential election, and the Jeffersonian press attacked Abigail as being too outspoken and imperious. One opponent, Albert Gallatin, wrote, quote, she is Mrs. President, not of the United States, but of a faction. It is not right. End quote. Excuse me.
What does that even mean?
She doesn't have to speak for the whole country. She is speaking for her own personal self.
I don't get out. Get it, Albert.
Now, Abigail and John's son Charles had been struggling with alcohol abuse, and he died a few days before the election, which hit them way harder than John Adams losing the election. I mean, obviously.
Sure.
But it is just kind of a strange parallel to Hamilton. You know?
Yeah.
Their son dying.
Double whammy.
Mm-hmm. So after the death of their son and losing the presidential election, they kind of retired from politics. Abigail still maintained a brisk correspondence, including with Thomas Jefferson, because that friendship kind of got repaired after things happened. She and John saw their son John Quincy's political career began to take off. He had a diplomatic post in London, and he was Secretary of State under James Madison. But John Adams, not John Quincy Adams, would live to see his son elected as the nation's sixth president, but Abigail did not.
Aww.
She died in October 1818 at the age of 73. Abigail, during her lifetime, didn't want her correspondence to be published because she thought a woman's letters were private.
Sure.
But in 1848, her grandson, Charles Francis Adams, John Quincy's youngest son, arranged the publication of her first volume of letters, which is awesome because that's where we get so much information of her personality, her experience, her perspective on American life and democracy and all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Here are some quotes and some fun facts.
Oh, I'm here. I'm strapped in.
This is from the letter that I read earlier about, like, we're going to foment a rebellion. I pulled it out because it's just better on its own.
Okay.
Quote, do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. End quote. And ain't it the truth?
Yeah. Yeah. Chisel that in stone on a monument somewhere.
Mm-hmm. In 1800, the Adams became the first family to occupy the White House.
Oh.
After the Capitol moved from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., which is really early. John Adams was only the second president of the United States.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when, because that's like a trivia question that I feel like gets asked.
Right.
And so many times I try to think like, well, who's like the fourth president? And John Adams.
John Adams.
Also, Abigail Adams is one of only two women to have been both wife and mother to U.S. presidents.
Wow.
The other is Barbara Bush.
That's it.
And that is Abigail Adams.
Wow.
Long overdue.
I love it. What a lady. I think that for next year when we do our speeches, we should do one of her letters.
Oh, I'm on board.
I think it's on the list. I think it's on the list.
Yeah. What's going on with Kate Barker?
Kate Barker, also known as Ma Barker, like Ma's and mother. Ma.
Oh boy.
Hey Ma. Hey Ma.
It's kind of never a good situation when somebody wants to be called Ma when they're not your mom.
Except she was. She was their mom.
This was, what?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to just be quiet
Are
and listen.
You
I'm not ready. I'm so, clearly not ready.
Here's a thing about Ma Barker. There's actually two possible directions that her story can go in. So
it's a choose your own adventure?
It is a choose your own adventure, and we will tell both stories.
Okay.
I'm using a royal we here for some reason. I will tell both okay. stories.
Great.
And then we'll talk a little bit about which is true and who profits from one being true over the other.
Can I guess?
Yeah.
Is it men?
Yeah.
I figured. Yeah. Saw that one yeah. coming.
So she's born Arizona Clark in Ash Grove, Missouri, to John and Emmeline Clark.
Her name is Arizona?
Arizona Clark.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Raising Arizona.
What a name.
I know. Her family called her Ari as she was growing up.
Hmm.
Much better than, what was it, Nabby?
Yeah.
Not much is really known about her childhood. She's described as, what we know of her is that she's described as headstrong and as having, quote, dark penetrating eyes and a nasty temper.
We know that
she went to church often. She played the fiddle. There is one story that mm-hmm. we're not like quite sure if it actually happened or not,
yeah.
where she saw Jesse James and like his band of outlaws ride through town, and that inspired her for a life of adventure. And you know, you can see where it's going.
Ethics.
You can see where it's going if Jesse James inspired your yeah. life of adventure.
Yep. I'm on board.
We're not entirely sure when she adopts the name Kate. Some stories say that it was in her childhood at some point mm-hmm. she started going by it. Some say that it's when she marries. In 1892, she marries a man named George Barker in Lawrence County, Missouri. And there are some stories that at some point during their marriage is when she adopted the name Kate. Whatever the reason, she starts going by Kate Barker. And between 1893 and 1901, she has four sons. Herman, Lloyd, Arthur, and Fred.
Fred. Classic Fred.
George would work a variety of low-skilled jobs. He worked at the Crystal Springs Water Company. He was a farmer, a watchman, a station engineer, and a clerk. They were all fairly illiterate. Like, education was not very important for them.
Kate and George, you mean?
Yeah.
So the whole family.
And the
then.
Kids as well. They okay. didn't place any attention on their education.
Hmm.
In fact, we have FBI documents that
whoa.
We have FBI documents
okay.
that describe the kids as more or less illiterate.
Hmm.
So okay. we get to 1910. Maybe I should start this way. The kids start out not being the best people.
Okay.
And we know that from a very young age, they are engaging in various crimes of one, you know, various okay. crimes of one sort or another. The first that we have real actual documentation of and that we know of is in 1910 when Herman, who is the oldest, is arrested when he's 17 for highway robbery after running over a child in the getaway car.
What?
Right. So this would
that
be...
just went from bad to 1,000 times worse.
It went from bad to real bad. And it don't get better. It don't get better. So over the next couple of years, all of the Barker sons end up repeatedly involved in crimes of increasing seriousness.
But not running over
including
kids.
Robbery and murder of various sorts. No more kids that I know of.
Okay. I mean, not that it's any better to murder an adult.
Right.
But I just wanted to right. ask. Okay.
1927, this is 10 years after this first robbery where he hits the kid with the car.
Uh-huh.
Herman is actually killed in Wichita, Kansas after a robbery and a confrontation with the police, which left an officer dead. Herman apparently shoots the officer at point blank range in the mouth and then kills himself to avoid prosecution. He ends up crashing the getaway car that he's in. And instead of being taken, he kills himself
wow.
to avoid the prosecution.
Wow. Yeah. Shooting a cop in the mouth.
Yeah. It's not the only time that they would kill police. It's one of many times when they would end up playing police officer. Barker.
Okay.
So by 1928, Lloyd ends up in prison in Leavenworth, Kansas. Arthur is in Oklahoma State Prison, and Fred is in Kansas State Prison.
Can I just have a really quick pause and say, this is why literacy is important. Okay, continue. Continue with the, whatever you're saying.
You know, I will say that out of all the stories we've done on this podcast, the ones that begin with, her dad took a lot of time to educate her.
Always secret, are the best.
Always go pretty well.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So by according to the Tulsa City Directory, 1928 is the last time that George, her husband, is listed as living with her. He gets tired of it. Now there are stories like
he gets tired of the criminality of the crime.
So there's a couple different stories here as well. Okay, this is how a lot of these like pivotal moments in Ma Barker's life are kind of like, it could have happened this way or it could have happened this way. Okay. And we're not entirely sure which it was. So in 1928, we know that George and Kate split.
Okay.
It could be that George doesn't do anything. We have a story where where one of the sons gets arrested and George says, oh, I'm not going to bail him out because he needs to be punished for his crimes.
Okay.
And Kate was always the one who was doing everything she could to excuse their behavior and try and get them out of trouble.
Gotcha.
And eventually he says, okay, I'm done. I'm leaving.
Yeah.
There's another story that says that she kicks him out. There's another story that says that George was perfectly happy to profit off of his son's crimes while they were in jail. And then he fled, you know, because they were he was basically using them. Whatever the case,
they split.
And then between 1928 and 1931, Ma Barker lives in poverty, essentially.
Yeah.
It's reported as a dirt floor shack. While her sons are in prison, I mean, she is living in abject poverty. And by 1930, she's living with a man named Arthur Dunlop, who was jobless and was not necessarily the best person in the world. But eventually they do become common law married because they end up living together for so long.
Okay.
1931 is when the big bad happens. The climax of this movie, this story, right?
Okay.
So 1931, her son Fred is released from jail, and he and his former prison mate, Alvin Karpis, find Kate, and with the other brothers, they found the Barker-Karpis gang. They start with these small crimes, these little petty crimes, but then eventually a series of robberies ends with the killing of a sheriff. His name was C. Roy Kelly in West Plains, Missouri on December 19th, 1931. They're forced to flee the area with Ma using false names, and it's from there that they would basically go on a crime spree across the nation from 1931 to 1935. Now, I did a rough accounting of all the crimes that were listed on Wikipedia.
Okay.
Because it was the only place where I could find like an actual listing of the individual crimes. They would engage in 10 robberies, including bank robberies, where one bank robbery, they got away with $250,000, which I used the Bureau of Labor Statistics inflation calculator, is equal to around $4.5 million in today's money. $4.5 million.
The silence you hear is because I have no words.
From one of the bank robberies.
Wow.
There's two other attempted robberies. There's 14 murders and 2 kidnappings. So they would travel around the country as a mother and her sons, which would basically allow them to avoid suspicion because...
Right. Oh, I just want to check into the motel with me and my boys.
And she would use fake names to rent out to rent hotel rooms where they would then commit their nefarious deeds from. March 29th, 1932 is when they rob this bank They robbed the Northwestern National Bank in Minneapolis. They make a clean getaway with about $4.5 million in today's money. Arthur then, in 1932, is released from prison, and he joins the gang, you know, adding to the family, you know, the family business.
Yep.
And they try to move to Chicago, but ultimately don't stay there because they would have had to work for Al Capone.
Yeah.
And they decide that's not... Yeah. They didn't want to do that. So they moved to St. Paul, Minnesota, which apparently was known as a haven for wanted criminals at the time.
I can't wait to tell Preston that. he'll go, oh, that's their side of the river.
Oh. And this is probably helped by the St. Paul police chief, who named Thomas Big Tom Brown, who helped them go from successful bank robbers to kidnappers.
What in the police chief of St. Paul? The chief
of St. Paul helped them avoid authorities. There's a story where Arthur Dunlop, her common-law husband, who had a problem of having loose lips when he was drunk, he gets drunk and accidentally spills where they were staying. And they only escape detection because Chief Brown lets them know that the police are coming for them.
Wow.
And after that incident, Mr. Dunlop is found naked on the side of, like, either under a bridge or on the side of the road with a single gunshot to his head.
What?
Yeah. Loose lips sink ships.
That is bananas.
The gang moves again to Menominee, Wisconsin. And Fred hides Ma Barker in a variety of hotels and hideouts because they didn't want her to learn too much about their crimes, to have like where you're like, don't know, so you can't really be accused of anything.
Yeah, implicated.
But also because apparently she would do her best to break up their relationships with their girlfriends, and they didn't want that happening. So they would like avoid, they would try to separate them as much as possible.
This just sounds like a Coen Brothers movie waiting to happen.
Absolutely. Joel and Ethan were,
her name is literally Arizona. What are we waiting for? What are we waiting for?
Now, by 1933, they returned to St. Paul to carry out two kidnappings of wealthy businessmen. This is where we get the kidnappings in. William Hamm and Edward Bremer are kidnapped. They demand $100,000 for each of them, about $1.8 million in today's money, and they get it from both. So they get about $3.6 million from these kidnappings in today's money. Now, this is when the FBI gets involved.
I mean, duh.
Because, and here's the interesting part, because they had this new technology called latent fingerprint identification.
Oh, hey.
It's like the DNA testing of their time.
Yep.
And they connect them to the kidnapping of one of these people by pulling fingerprints. And they actually have to flee St. Paul with the FBI chasing them. And they return to Chicago to try and launder the money. Now, the FBI finally catches the family the next year. They arrest Arthur on January 8th, 1935. And this dummy has a literal map on his person with the locations of all of the other gang members.
Well, he wasn't literate. Jeanette, how did you think he was going to find them?
Jeanette wrote a note in here where she said, seriously, he was carrying a map with everyone else's locations? 4 question marks. I thought they were professional criminals.
Clearly not. Well, they can't read. Again, so, literacy is important even if you're a criminal.
They never had book fairs at their elementary schools.
Oh.
It turns out that Fred and Ma Barker were renting a house in Florida under a fake name. Of course, it's Florida.
And Chicago. And like, we're just hitting the top all crime the
high
spots.
Points. All the high points. Yep. And Leavenworth. On January 16th, 1935, the police surround the house.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that they would find all of the gang members, but it turns out only Fred and Ma are there. They order them to surrender, and Fred opens fire.
Now, are you kidding me, Fred?
Now, what would follow was an intense, hours-long shootout. Hours-long. And actually, there are stories of the local townspeople, like, packing picnics and coming to have picnics and watching. Just watching the shootout happen.
Wow.
Once all the shots, you know, the mm-hmm. everyone runs out of their bullets. The FBI and police, they have a local handyman, like a local
yeah.
a guy who worked on the estate.
A fixer-upper.
They had him put on a bulletproof vest and go in to check. Which doesn't really seem like it should be proper FBI protocol. Yeah.
If they have a bulletproof vest, why aren't they the ones going in? I have so many questions.
This is the 1930s Herbert Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover. So sorry, Herbert.
not that he was much better.
Thank you, Great Depression. So they have him go in and they find Ma and Fred's bodies.
Dead from the shootout.
The interesting thing is that Fred's body is riddled with bullets.
Yeah.
Ma's body, one bullet. According to the FBI, there was a Tommy gun in her hands. There are other stories that say the Tommy gun was lying between their two bodies, not in her possession. Mm. The FBI would then, they put the bodies actually on public display.
Yeah.
And then stored them unclaimed until October 1st, 1935, when relatives had them buried in Welch, Oklahoma, next to Herman, who had died in 1927.
Okay.
Now, here's where we get to the other side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Ma Barker is portrayed in many different places, including in popular culture, in movies, mm-hmm. in songs, and in official FBI accounts
yeah.
as the leader slash matriarch of the Barker gang.
Yeah.
But many historians don't actually believe that to be true. There are many who mm-hmm. believe that the story of her as the leader was encouraged by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI to justify them killing an old woman, to justify the killing of Ma Barker, which otherwise may have been unpalatable to the larger American public.
Right. Wow.
After Ma's death, we actually have a quote from J. Edgar Hoover claiming that Ma Barker was, quote, the most vicious, dangerous, and resourceful criminal brain of the last decade. He also claimed that she enjoyed a lavish lifestyle that was the fruit of her son's crimes and supposedly had a string of lovers. Of course, bringing in the loose yeah. woman yeah. stereotype. But then we have this quote from Alan Karpis. And if you remember, he's the other, this is the Barker yeah. Karpis gang.
Yeah.
This is the Alan Karpis yeah. who actually wrote a biography with another writer. Yeah. And he has this quote. The most ridiculous story in the annals of crime is that Ma Barker was the mastermind behind the Karpis Barker gang.
Mm-hmm.
Note he calls it the Karpis Barker gang.
I mean, duh.
She wasn't a leader of criminals or even a criminal herself. There is not one police photograph of her or set of fingerprints taken while she was alive. She knew we were criminals, but her participation in our careers was limited to one function. When we traveled together, we moved as a mother and her sons. What could look more innocent?
Wow.
We actually have another criminal who backs up this story. His name is Harvey Bailey, who knew the gang pretty uh-huh. well. And he said, quote, Ma couldn't plan breakfast, let alone a criminal enterprise. And so that's
yeah.
where we get these two stories from. The other two Barker sons, Arthur and Lloyd, will also meet untimely ends eventually. Arthur is killed trying to escape Alcatraz in 1939.
Oops.
And Lloyd was murdered by his wife in 1949.
Whoa, that's a story.
And the whole family, and Ma in particular, yeah. would go on to be, again, immortalized
in popular culture
many times yeah. over. So that's the story of Kate Barker.
That's fascinating.
I agree. You know, it's a story of a quote-unquote bad lady, which I thought was important for us to cover, you know, have yeah. a good lady yeah. and a bad lady for our 100th
mm-hmm,
episode.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's a story like many we've had before
yeah.
where it's, you know, there is an official version of her life and
yeah.
one that is known by many yeah. different people, but there's also possibly yeah. another story or another thing, right? And so who profits from having
right. yeah.
the one version versus the yep. other? So that's Ma Barker.
I like it.
Yeah.
Our cause of the week this week? It's going to be you.
Me?
No, our listeners.
Oh, I see.
You, who is listening to this episode right now. Because seriously, we would not have the energy or the willpower to keep doing this podcast without knowing that we have our loyal listeners out there who learn from this podcast, who gain something from this podcast. And we really want to reach new listeners and have more people understand and experience the full story of history. So if you've been waiting on writing us a review on whatever platform that you enjoy listening on, or giving us a couple of stars, if you just want to do something super quick, or even just waiting to reach out and suggest a woman that you'd like us to cover, or a story that you'd like us to delve deeper into, I would encourage you, for our cause this week, to do that now.
Those ratings and reviews, they help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. And as Allison said, we are so grateful, and we do see every single one of them. Jeanette will respond if you write to us on Twitter or on Instagram. I'll respond. Allison responds sometimes. Jess responds sometimes. You will get a personal response from one of us if you reach out. It makes my heart flutter every time we get one.
So thanks.
Thank you. Seriously.
As always, we couldn't do the show, however, without our incredible team who you just mentioned. So shout out to Jeanette,
Jess,
and Sydney.
If you'd like to keep in contact with us, you can find us on Facebook,
Twitter,
and Instagram.
Just search The Bitchery of History.
Or you can also find us at thebitcheryofhistory.com.
And remember,
bitches get stuff done.